Rapping with Reef Boam is sponsored by Champion Lighting and Supply, Polo Reef, and Fauna Marine.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? And welcome back to another episode of Rapping with Reef Boam. I'm your host, Keith Berkelhammer. So today I have the pleasure of welcoming back two legends in the hobby, Julian Sprung and Charles Delbake. How you doing there, gentlemen?
You guys
doing great. How are you guys all doing? And ladies.
Wonderful.
We almost didn't make it on time. We had some more technical difficulties, but this time these two guys were able to all work it out and get on the air on time. So yeah, very psyched to have you both on again. Also psyched to see all the folks in the chat. Julian and Charles are very well known for co-authoring a revolutionary series of books called The Reef Aquarium. There are three volumes. I have volumes 1 and 3. You guys got to give me a little intel in terms of where I could find volume 2, because for some reason I'm missing volume 2. Is that even available anymore? Is it out of print?
All of
do I have to pay like $500 on the black market or something?
It's $5,000. Yeah, no.
where's volume 4? You don't have volume 4 either.
No,
oh, that's right.
There is no volume 4.
Not yet.
Yes. So I think I can help you out, Keith.
That would be awesome. So Julian has published other books and written numerous articles about the hobby. He co-founded his company, Two Little Fishies, with Daniel Ramirez back in 1991. Julian is also a frequent speaker at aquarium conferences and club events. Besides being an author and lecturer, Charles is currently the curator of aquarium projects at Steinhardt Aquarium. Is that still the current role, Charles?
Okay. Yes, it is.
Okay, in San Francisco, California, prior to that. He worked at the Waikiki Aquarium with Dr. Bruce Carlson. Charles was also one of the driving forces behind organizing the first ever MACNA in 1989, which was held in Toronto, where he lived. Hopefully, there'll be another MACNA this year. Let's keep the fingers crossed. So before we start chatting with Julian and Charles, I want to take care of some business and thank the sponsors of this show. My sponsors are really important because they make this show possible with their support, and that means a lot since I want to continue to bring on awesome guests to help foster a learning environment on the show. One sponsor is Champion Lighting and Supply. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Polo Reef. Make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday. Andrew and the team took 8 huge Japanese koi cross-country to the All-American Koi Show in Las Vegas and scored a victory, winning the first place, grand champion, and more. I'm going to show this this koi. This thing is like, wow. That thing is just stunning, spectacular. And so between the stress of transporting these massive fish, the honor of all Japanese judges, and the fun of Vegas, the video is something you definitely don't want to miss. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polo Reef for video drop notifications. And then finally, my third sponsor is Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine Reef ICP Total Test Kit, which gives quick, accurate, and an easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums, from macro elements to trace elements and pollutants. You get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. All right, so with all that out of the way, let's get into it, guys. Quick question. Have you guys ever tried to keep koi? I have never attempted that.
No, I have not.
All right, moving on.
But I confess to appreciating them very much. I've been to a number of trade shows where they've had, especially in Europe, you see them, these big round tubs with the heavy-duty, very expensive, high-end koi. And I admire them. They're exquisite to look at. So That's a future.
They are stunning, and I'm sure that is a whole nother thing in terms of trying to raise and keep them. It seems like it's an art form.
Yeah, yes. I've been to Japan several times, as has Julian, and I've seen some koi ponds in Kyoto in a restaurant that have over $50,000-$60,000 worth of koi in them.
Yeah,
it's a big deal.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a lot bigger hobby than reef keeping. Or maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know. Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, they have their own vets, so that tells you about the investment. And
there you go.
It's definitely bigger in Europe. I mean, you see it, you know, in the UK and in France, they have garden shops that feature them. And then, of course, there's, you know, just like with coral keepers, there's the high-end societies and groups that specialize in obtaining the rare
individuals. And those rare ones are not cheap.
No.
I'm kind of curious what a grand champion would fetch these days in the marketplace, but let's not go there. So guys, the last time I had you on about a year ago, we talked about using antibiotics, oxalic acid, Cipro, you know, in tank treatments to help treat RTN and STN for SPS, as well as for issues with LPS. Todd from Champion Lighting and Supply wanted me to ask you about this, and you know, so there was some discussion, he said, about oxalic acid on the reef related Discord channel. What is a Discord channel, by the way? Have you guys ever heard of a Discord channel? I guess these things are like a server based type of platform.
Just like the gamers use Discord to chat.
That's how I'm familiar with it. My nephew showed me that.
Yeah. All right. You learn something new every day. So, Julian, you're working on the OA protocol and a paper with Zach Ransom at the Frost Museum. Can you comment on the ongoing research? This is what Todd is asking, and if when the paper will be released. And I think a side note that Todd wanted to make. Point here is that the FDA made it harder to get Cipro by sending a warning letter to online vendors. Most of them have pulled Cipro or made it only available with a prescription. So, Julian, can you comment on that?
Yeah. So the whole oxalic acid information thing. Oh, have we lost Charles? It was something that started with a great frustration I had with bacterial infections in elegance corals. And I had seen it over many, many years. And there were some new types of infections I was seeing that were particularly virulent. And so I knew that if it was happening, in my experience, that pretty much everyone was probably seeing the same thing and not really talking about it. So an opportunity came up, and there was, as happens a couple of times a year, an amazing elegance coral, and it was perfectly healthy. And I bought it, and I thought, probably I'm going to have this again, but gosh, it looks so good. And went through the same symptoms that I had seen on other occasions. And it just made me put my foot down finally. And I called up Zach Ransom, who was at that time at Frost Science Museum. And I said, listen, this is just, it's a terrible, awful thing. And it's gotta be destroying elegance corals in captivity right now. I can't keep one of these things except, I do have multiple colonies of a resistant strain. They never get sick, which is a whole other subject. But this other variety, when you see these spectacularly colored ones, they would always get sick. It was just a matter of time. So I said to him, I'll buy one and I will hold it. It's going to take, I don't know, a week, 2 weeks, something like that. Once it gets symptoms, I will bring it to you. You will carefully isolate it, Zach, And hopefully your veterinarian will be able to swab it and get some kind of an idea of what's causing this symptom. And then treat it. You know, hopefully we'll have time to be able to see what the organism, the bacteria, is sensitive to. That was the general gist of conversation. He said, yeah, let's go for it. And he did. An initial attempt with, now I can't remember what antibiotic he used initially, was not effective, but a follow-up with oxalic acid was 100% effective, cured the coral, and that coral is still alive at Frost Science. I've seen it relatively recently, and that was several years ago. Now, his veterinarian and Zach had a treatment that consisted of bats. An article has been written off the top of my head. I don't remember the exact dosage used and how long the bath was, but there is a lot of flexibility in how to do this. But I would emphasize that treating in a bath like this and then removing the coral, it's an effective way that kind of replicates what we do. You know, when you're treating people, you have a dosage, you take it, and then, you know, it's either every day or every so many days, you're taking it and you run a course. Which is what Zach did, and it was effective. Now, he and I talked about writing an article about it, and then we also discussed how it would be useful to talk to the trade, you know, speak to wholesalers and say, you know, if we don't mention this, there'd be a lot of corals, a lot of elegance corals that would probably die as we wait to publish this. So we kind of let the cat out of the bag privately. Jake Adams was one person I spoke to, and he spoke to a lot of people. Chris at ACI was aware of it, and a few other people. So Jake, being Jake, decided to experiment and try some different dosages, and even went so far as to say, look, you know, this stuff seems to be fairly benign. It's not a very strong, you don't see a bad reaction by corals or even fishes. He said, let me just try treating a tank where I'm seeing symptoms, bacterial symptoms in LPS corals, and it worked. So there is some precedent for actually treating whole systems, and that kind of makes sense in a wholesale setting. But there's a lot of questions that brings up, because how often do you dose? Do you do water change? What do you do with the water that you're changing to kill off any resistant bacteria strains, to denature the antibiotic? Lots of subject matter there, more than we can get into, and I don't want to dominate the whole Reef Bum episode right now. But this will be published. There is an upcoming issue of Coral Magazine that's all about coral diseases. Chris and Amanda at ACI have done independently a study with Roy Yanong, who's a veterinarian in Florida. And their work has generated some data and also generated some questions. So there will be follow-up studies. I'm reviewing some of their data right now. And I think, although it hasn't been 100% decided, I think that probably the initial article that Zach and I wrote will end up being published possibly in that issue of Coral that's coming as a, you know, initial mention. And then whether some of the work that Chris and Amanda have done will be included in that, or possibly the next issue, that hasn't been decided yet. But will be decided within days. It's a current subject.
So Julian, in that article, will there be a protocol for hobbyists to potentially follow with the oxalic acid for in tank as well as dip?
I think if we see the basic article that Zach and I wrote, and it's a short article, there is a protocol there, and I support it. And it's a bath treatment. And, you know, after doing that, the water used with the antibiotic can be treated with chlorine to denature the antibiotic. And I think that's essential before disposing of it, you know, either outside or in the waste water. You know, we don't want to be saving our corals and harming humanity. I think it's important that we follow protocols and do the right thing. So, and the availability of these antibiotics, you know, as people start using them more often to treat corals, it's something that's likely to be strongly regulated and may end up being something you need to get by prescription through a veterinarian. That's something that I've always kind of supported over the years, but the aquarium industry has been a little bit funny about it because, you know, the truth is veterinarians in general aren't trained, mostly aren't trained in fish and corals. And so the whole matter of subscription or prescriptions is a challenging topic.
Julian, how far off are we from potentially having a protocol for in-tank treatment?
I think that Chris and Amanda have a fair amount of experience now, so I would leave it to them to be able to answer that question. Jake had a treatment, which I have it in the email communications I had with him back at that time. This is going back a couple of years already now. So I know that I did try what he suggested on two systems, and it did work. It was effective, not against all bacterial infections in corals, but some. And that creates, you know, the situation where I know that it works against this very virulent and common condition in elegance corals. And I know it works in some other corals, but it's not a be-all, end-all. Cipro is also very effective in some bacterial infections, but not all. I know that hobbyists are aware that amoxicillin is also very effective. Just a couple of days ago, a hobbyist called me up and was complaining about a bacterial infection he had, and he talked to me about what he considered to be something everybody knew, but I'd never heard of. He talked about a KFC treatment, which generated a fried chicken image in my head. But he said, oh yeah, basically you mix all these antibiotics. And I thought, oh, how convenient, what a stupid idea. Because then you don't know which one is actually effective. And then now you're training bacteria against all of these really important antibiotics that are used in people. So it's really hard to put a lasso around the aquarium industry once you let a treatment like this out of the bag. I would hope that there is some respect for how important it is to follow protocols and not just willy-nilly create recipes and concoctions. The fact that Roy Anong is involved in the work that Chris and Amanda are doing, I think is encouraging, and I look forward to their publication where he can give a more academic approach to how veterinarians would suggest dosing, treating, and following up.
Charles,
we've done a lot of work. Yeah, we've done a lot of work with, we've used oxalic acid and enrofloxacin and Cipro and amoxicillin. So we've used all of those and in various treatments. Some we put into a paste to apply to larger colonies that we cannot pull out and give baths to. And in other cases, we've done immersion baths over a few hours. We've done 24 hours treatment and retreating every 3 days in the same system, but not a community system of corals. And I think, you know, the work that's being done in Florida on this is going to be critical because they will tell us what the bacterium is or what the infectious agent is, which will then it will then inform us as to what other antibiotics might also be effective towards it. So you're not just doing the KFC method and using a shotgun and not really knowing. Because, you know, it's become increasingly obvious that there's a huge population of beneficial bacteria that live on coral and that provide nutrients to the coral, that provide resistance against pathogenic bacteria as well. And so by using indiscriminately antibiotics, you are not just attacking the problem child, you are attacking all bacteria on that lives on that coral, so, and in your system. So we need more informed usage in terms of what are we targeting and what can you use to specifically target it. It's like, you know, with the cancer treatments now where they're specifically targeting a certain type of cell with a certain type of drug so that you're not affecting everything around it.
Big ES is making a comment. It would be interesting seeing aquabiomic results with oxalic acid treatments. Have you guys done any pre-post studies with aquabiomics with Cipro or OA? Well,
no, but you have.
I have.
But I think that, you know, in some of the data from Chris and Amanda, there is some interesting stuff that we'll see in that regard. Now, I wanted to comment. Thanks, Charles, for exactly everything you said. But at the same time, the encouraging thing that I'm seeing out there in conversations and in development in our hobby is looking at probiotic alternatives to the antibiotics. And that's not just in the hobby. It's also, you see it in the coral restoration work where people are treating corals on the reef. So there's really two schools of thought and even sub-schools of thought on that. On how to effectively manage disease in the wild as well as in our aquariums. So it's actually an exciting time for new information to come out there. And I'm excited to see that there are qualified academics that are involved. It's not just the seat of the pants effort.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of literature coming out in the last couple of years on probiotics and seeding and using this on to treat coral disease in the wild and the importance of these different strains and how they affect. I've got several papers. I think I've got a file now with like 30 papers in there just talking about bacterial diseases and the use of probiotics. So there's a lot of work being done on it. You know, and I also think that there's work that I've been doing in terms of our big tank of some things that I've discovered were perhaps the cause of some of the issues that we've had over the years, and that is the balance between nitrogen and phosphorus, the so-called NP ratio, and how that can also impact coral health. And I know there's a lot of talk about adding ammonia to improve your corals and nitrates, and there's a lot of literature out there that's very conflicting as to what the effects of doing that are, and it's becoming more and more clear that it's a balance between the two, not just one or the other. And a lot of, you have to also remember that a lot of the research that's being done is they're trying to predict what's going to happen with climate change, increasing temperature, decreasing pH, decreasing alkalinity, and increasing nutrient levels. So a lot of their focus is bumping up one thing and depressing another. Whereas in our case, there are some things that are elevated, but we're also elevating other things that are beneficial, like alkalinity, well beyond natural seawater levels. So there's a lot to the whole disease thing. And we've seen it in our big tank that if we get to a certain ratio, we start getting all kinds of bacterial issues that we have to treat white patchy. We get a lot of issues with ciliates as well when our balance gets out of a certain range. At least that's my anecdotal observations about it. But we've been able to reproduce it a couple of times. Not on purpose, but accidentally, where we've seen, you know, the negative effects of getting too great of a ratio between nitrogen and phosphorus. Which I'm actually working on an article for that as well. That I hope to. It's a follow up of the article I wrote back in 2015 in Reefs.org, Advanced Aquarist, about coral growth and the role that these different nutrients play. And, you know, we all heard stories of people that have very high phosphate levels, very high nitrate levels that still have great coral growth. And there are reasons behind that. And I think one of them is this NP ratio.
Interesting. Let's definitely want to talk more about that, Charles. But getting back to antibiotics, At what point do we have to get worried that there's hobbyists out there that just kind of read this stuff about, you know, Cipro, oxalic acid? They see things, you know, certain corals are dying in their tank, or they're losing a head on a torch, or an SPS colony is RTNing or STNing on them, and they just kind of want to do that, you know, quick fix. Everybody's talking about this new thing, OA or Cipro, and you know, that can be a slippery slope, right? If you're just pretty much willing to hit something with antibiotics right off the bat versus maybe digging a little down deeper and seeing if there is another root cause of that versus maybe a bacteria thing. I mean, obviously, I think the bacteria are opportunistic. The pathogenic bacteria are opportunistic. So if there is something out of whack, then maybe perhaps that will leave the door open for them to kind of pounce. But what? How worried should we be that we're going to become too antibiotic centric in this hobby of ours in terms of reef keeping, and that people will just kind of, you know, willy nilly start adding antibiotics to their tank, potentially causing resistant strains of, you know, these pathogenic bacteria?
Well, I mean, that's what I was focusing on. It worries me a lot. And
it's going to happen. People are going to do it. I mean, we've all been in that situation where you're faced this coral that you've grown for years or whatever, all of a sudden starts running quickly. I mean, what are you going to do? You're not going to start testing.
Time is the reason, because these problems don't just proceed slowly. It's suddenly you've got an issue, and if you don't act, then you're going to lose it. The hobbyist who called me the other day had a collection of corallomorphs, you know, mushroom anemones, and they get these infections too. And yeah, it doesn't take long for them to die, you know? So without a quick fix, it's a loss, you know? And it's one of those things that we have to accept that it's part of the aquarium hobby. It's part of the reef in nature, that in general, despite good conditions, these infections just bloom up for no particular reason, it seems. And the pathogenic bacteria are not aliens that you've suddenly introduced. They're probably common bacteria that are in every system, and for some reason they become virulent. So, you know, sometimes it's an introduction. You buy a new coral, and although it looks fine, it's carrying something virulent on it. You put it in your tank, and within days, all of a sudden, all your corals are sick. I've seen that happen. But sometimes you have a tank that has had no new additions, and an infection pops up like a little forest fire. And if you weren't there to catch it, you'd lose everything.
What's the best advice if you don't have that quick fix? If you're not going to be using antibiotics, what's the best advice to try to put a stop to that sort of fire spreading?
Remove the affected colony. Have more than one aquarium. Put it in separate system, because it is kind of fire-like. The spread will be from the affected colony to adjacent ones. If you can remove the affected one and then deal with it, treat it in a separate tank, that's better than doing nothing.
What about large water changes, a series of large water changes? Would that help?
If the affected colony is still in the system, not really. No. Because it's not really water quality. I think it's probably going to be a long time before we can really make a connection between, this type of infection occurs when some measurable parameter is here to here. It's intriguing what you're observing, Charles, with the nutrient levels. That you know, could very well be something that precipitates certain types of infections. But I don't think it's a guarantee. In other words, a certain water quality parameter direction might increase the likelihood of certain infections. But I think that saying that, oh, if you prevent that from happening and you keep it in this range, you'll never have an infection. I think that that's sort of tempting the the reef gods to prove you wrong. These things can, I think, spontaneously happen. It's hard to be 100% in control. I remember having that argument with Richard Harker back in the day. He used to always chase the what is wrong that's causing this, and I used to say, nope, lightning strike. You know, you can be perfectly healthy and struck by lightning, and you're going to burn. So,
it does kind of blow my mind, because I guess what you're saying, Julian, is that it is something that potentially could be transferred from one tank to another if you're passing along an infected coral.
Yep. Oh yeah. Without a doubt. And quarantine wouldn't necessarily even stop it. I mean, the corals that, or the bacteria that are throughout your tank have the potential to become virulent. And the question is why? You know, what's going to make that happen? We know from scientific literature that temperature is one thing that will do that. But there's probably a whole number of other things, including, as Charles mentioned, the ratio of nutrients could very well. Algae, you know, different microalgae and algae have been shown to influence bacteria. And whether they're pathogenic. So we all know that we struggle with algae in our reef aquariums, so it could be that certain types of algae appearing may precipitate issues with bacterial infections as well.
And there's also the viruses as well that we don't really know a lot about. Right. And there's a lot of research now on viral diseases and how you can actually use viral phages to introduce resistance into corals. So lots of work being done now with viruses as well.
Right. We talked about that in volume 3 of the book, how phages could be basically the puppeteers managing the microbiome in our closed system aquariums. You can have great success for a period of time based on that population regulation of which strains of bacteria you have, and viruses may be a part of that, and then suddenly throw things off kilter.
So the DIP protocol could potentially be a very big thing in terms of preventing that passing along of the bad guy bacteria.
Yeah. Well, I think who should be paying a lot of attention are the major wholesale coral importers. And so, you know, that's why I thought sharing that with key players was helpful before publishing. Because, you know, if specifically with Elegance Coral, if they can be treated properly before they enter the aquarium hobby, you know, en route from Indonesia, Australia, wherever they're coming from, that's likely to increase their survival long term and reduce the incidence of these problems, which could potentially be spreading to other corals.
Let's go back to Charles, the conversation we're having about the balance between nitrates and phosphates. Telegram Jim is asking thoughts on ciliates being the result of the negative impact to corals due to the unbalanced nitrates to phosphate ratio.
Yeah, for me, it's just anecdotal. I know that we had a huge issue back just as COVID was starting with ciliates. We lost whole walls full of echinopora that we had. We lost a bunch of stuff to ciliates, and not just helicostoma, but there's a whole range of ciliate diseases that are out there. So it's been a problem that we've encountered several times, especially on, we've seen it on Hidden Offer as well. And it's usually when our, and looking back historically at my nitrogen and phosphorus numbers and looking at my ratio, it's well over 200 to 300 when we've had these issues.
Wow.
And once I get it below 150 or 200 even lower is even better, things tend to turn around. And I've been talking with some researchers in Monaco who've been working on nitrogen and phosphorus for years about their impacts on corals. And we know that for the fact that if we increase the nitrogen too high, that we do get issues with disease and pests and things like that. So I think one of the things that's important, that a lot of people keep talking about the Redfield ratio, there's a couple of points that I'd like to point out. Some people probably already know this, but I think a lot of people may not realize it, that that is actually not a ratio of nitrate to phosphate. It's a ratio of nitrogen to phosphorus. It's also a molar ratio. So it's based on the molecular weight. It's not based on the mass. It's not a massic ratio. So that's 16 to 1 ratio. It's a molar ratio of nitrogen to phosphorus. So you have to take that into account when you look at your numbers. You have to convert them. Also, the 16 to 1 ratio is based on algae. And corals and the zooxanthellae with them actually have a much different ratio. If they look at the tissue of the coral and the zooxanthellae separately, they're both different, but it's as high as 50 to 1 or 60 to 1. There's also a variation between species. Some have different ratios than others. So there's a lot that goes into when you start talking about that, which I think a lot of people don't realize. And everyone's fixated on the 16 to 1 ratio. Well, first, you've got to change your nitrate to nitrogen, your phosphate to phosphate phosphorus, and then you can get a massic ratio. And I think the 16 to 1 translates to like 7.23 to 1 in terms of mass, or you just convert it to micromolar, and that's what a lot of the literature is in. So it makes it easier to compare. There's a couple of websites that can make that help you to make those kinds of conversions. I don't think I can throw one in. Do I have access to the chat?
Yeah, you could, Charles, certainly drop a link in the chat.
Yeah.
If you can.
So it's something I'm still trying to, you know, to tease out and doing more, just more reading of the scientific literature and before I go with too much depth as of what I think is going on. And I would preface it all by saying, you know, this is what I have found in our system. Doesn't mean that it's going to be the same for your system. And, you know, it's a lot of people are saying now that it's, you know, the researchers are saying that it's not so much the value of the nitrogen or phosphorus, but the ratio that is more critical. And we know that people keep tanks with very, very high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus and everything seems to do well. But there are also some caveats in doing that, because what we normally see is you see an increase in zooxanthellae populations in some cases. In other cases, you see an increase in chlorophyll. But basically, you see an increase in photosynthesis, which is a greater demand for carbon, which is in the form of carbonate and bicarbonate, which then now you're competing against the coral for calcification. So you have to balance that out. If you have too much of a nitrogen demand, then phosphorus becomes limiting. And that's what causes the problems, because now these corals are phosphorus starved, even at very high levels. Because there's so much nitrogen, the zooxanthellae are just sucking it right up. And there's a very high demand for phosphorus as a result of that. So it's a balance that you have to keep in mind. And with these high growth rates at these high values, you also see much less dense skeletons. And there's greater porosity in those skeletons. So they're much more brittle. So in the wild, that's a problem, because with high nitrogen levels, the corals will grow faster, but they'll be more brittle and they won't withstand wave action.
So Charles, I did drop that link for the molarity calculator in the chat, so people do have access to that. Thank you for passing that along. An old friend and colleague, Alex Correa, is watching, and he made one comment. Well, he's made a few comments. One comment, it is known that the excess of nutrients is one of the important factors to be considered. Organic nutrients could be one of the key subjects. Those nutrients aren't measured by hobbyists.
Yeah, they're not, but you can measure total nitrogen. And if you then measure your ammonia, nitrite, nitrate, and subtract that from total, that gives you your organic measurement. And that's how, when I was back in, when I was working at Waikiki, we used to send our water up to a lab at University of Hawaii. And that's what they did there, basically. They figured out the total nitrogen, all the inorganic nitrogen, subtracted it, and they gave you a rough number as to what the organic value was. There's been some research looking at what the role of organic nitrogen and phosphorus is, and what that can do. And in some cases, there's been no effect. The other interesting thing is that soft corals are turning out to be much more different than stony corals and their needs for nitrogen and phosphorus. That a few studies that have been done with sarcophyton and cinularia is increasing the nitrogen and phosphorus values in their water hasn't really resulted in an increase in uptake. And so there's a lot of debate about why that is.
So a couple of questions from Anthony, and one's going back to the antibiotic topic, and the other is related to the nitrogen-phosphorus ratio we're just talking about right now. Any thoughts of antibiotic use for clam disease? I've lost several old clams suddenly and suspect Perkinsus, pinched mantle. Yeah, clams. I mean, I've kind of given up on trying to keep clams.
Well, Perkinsus is a ciliate, so antibiotic is not going to really work on a ciliate. Yeah. And depending on how invasive the infection is, a freshwater bath can work. But we've lost some in the past where we've given freshwater baths, and we send most everything we lose, we send out for necropsy to labs, and basically try to find out why, what killed them. And in that particular animal's case, it was in all the organs. Mm. And so a freshwater bath is not going to work for that. But I have seen anecdotally antibiotics seem to improve. One particular clam we had that wasn't opening much. And after the antibiotic treatment was actually a system that we treated, and clam happened to be in it. And it actually started to open up much better. I thought, wow, great. We cleared, we fixed it up. And unfortunately, a few months later, it did it again and we lost it really quickly. And so I think the mistake we made is we didn't do repeated treatments. Yeah, we should have had at least three or four treatments to really knock it down. Otherwise, you're just creating a resistant strain. But we knocked it back, but it, whatever it was came back. And the product that we used was a proprietary product from a manufacturer. And, you know, so I can't say what was in it, but there were some antibiotics in there.
Do you guys have any theories as to why it's...
Julian's got some stuff to add to that.
I wanted to add on that. So as Charles said, Perkinsus is, you know, ciliate, and that doesn't really apply. But there are bacterial infections that affect clams. And I, just like the, what's his name, Anthony, who asked the question, lost recently some very old and precious clams. To bacterial infection. I wasn't sure, but I suspected it was. And it was extremely frustrating because it was like the kind of a situation that is designed to, poke the wound, pester an expert like me. when it proceeded, and it happened in two phases, but when it proceeded, if you could imagine having a collection of clams in one system. And as happens, if you've ever kept clams, suddenly one clam dies. But you look at the system and everything looks good. You test the water quality and everything's fine. And the other clams in the tank all look fine. So as an expert, you tell yourself, well, I haven't added anything new here. Everybody looks good. There are bristle worms in this system. Maybe a bristle worm just got up there and bothered that clam and it died, you know, and you go, damn, I really need to do something about those bristle worms, right? And so then a few days later, another clam dies. And at that point you realize, oh, this is possibly something bigger, but all the other clams look fine. And remember, it's one of those things, let's say it's, you know, whether it's a tank at home and you look at the clam and it's fine in the morning, you get back from work and it's dead, or it's clams at work and you look at them and they're totally fine when you leave in the evening and you come in the morning and it's totally dead in the morning after being fine. And the remaining clams, key figure here, remaining clams are great. Water quality is great. What do you do aside from pray, cry? So I can tell you the answer to that question is, number one, remove the clams from that system. And number two, treat them with an antibiotic. Now, which antibiotic you use, that one you need to find a veterinarian who's very interested in your problem, which you cannot find. Me, I tried two at public aquariums. I told them my situation because I'd had it once it happened, and then it started again in another system, and I knew what I was in for. So veterinarians are very busy. They don't have time for your clam problem. And so what I did, not searching online to see what other people have done, although my son was at home and he was sympathetic to my anxiety, my son starts looking on his phone and he's telling me about Prekinsis. And I'm like, Lewis, come on. Do you know who you're talking to? And I tell him why it's not Prekinsis. And in any case, I said, you know what? I'm just going to try. I happen to have.
That's the last time he's going to help you.
Yeah. No, I was actually excited that he was interested. You know, he really, you know, the fact that he was interested in my plight, the fact that he was trying to talk down to me and say, oh, no, Dad, you know, I look and it's just that. I'm like, no, no, no. I had some amoxicillin. I had had a cold, I forget how much, a while before, and I had a couple of pills left over, which I thought this could be useful at some point. And I did a Hail Mary, and I did an amoxicillin treatment on one remaining clam, and I knew it was going to be dead within a day or two, and it survived. It was fine. Unfortunately, like you, Charles, I didn't do a follow-up treatment, and I went on a trip, and although it was perfectly fine when I left on the trip, there was an empty shell when I came back. That was the clam god saying, there you go. You need to research this some more, and you should have done more than one treatment. The one treatment absolutely saved that clam because every other clam died. I know that's anecdotal, but trust me, after having lost, I think it's more than a dozen clams, and they all died exactly the same way this one was going to die, but it didn't, except later. Amoxicillin was effective against that particular bacterial infection affecting clams. I can tell you the only symptom that I saw in any of the clams was a slight gaping. It was not the, you know, gaping. It was just like the clams would do with their mouth, like a little, which was unusual. Okay, just a little bit of that, no pinched mantle. If they started doing that little mouth funny thing, within a day they were gone. And it just was heartbreaking. And so I have no idea what it was that started it. It just, you know, I think it's hubris, being proud, happy for the clams that you've had for years. And, you know, people saying, wow, how do you do that? Well, I'm careful. I quarantine them really carefully. I don't put a new clam in there. A new clam goes in another tank. I have it for months or a year before it goes in with these guys. That worked really well for me to build up a population up to the point that the clam god said, no, no, no. Now you suffer. So thanks for the question. It's just like the corals, there's much to learn, and antibiotics can be helpful. It would be great to do follow-up studies with a veterinarian involved to know what bacteria are present before and after. Lots of work to be done.
What are your thoughts, you guys, in terms of, you know, again, with clams, in terms of the, Anthony's wondering, you know, opinion on the nitrogen-phosphorus ratio for them as well. Is there a particular ratio that, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I think I know that, you know, clam farmers have certainly proved that adding ammonium or ammonia to the system is great for pushing growth rates. I don't know whether anyone's actually looked at nitrogen to phosphorus ratios with giant clams.
All right, so
yeah, I have to say that like all the issues that we had, our clams were fine through it all. So I do have some photos that if you want to share, I can share them on what the corals looked like and what the results of fixing our ratio was, if you're interested.
Yeah, I can't share that on the fly, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Unless you could potentially put it in front of your camera, but that's probably an impossibility given that you're probably at a laptop or...
Well, couldn't that be added after too? Like, you know, if you're not able to put it live like this, you could.
Well, if you guys could like talk amongst yourselves for 5 minutes, I could potentially do this if I.
So if I share my screen, it doesn't work. Is that what you're saying?
Let's see here. Try, Charles. Did you put something in the chat yet?
No, I'm trying to find where I put them.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, move along, and we can. Carry on. Talk amongst yourselves.
Right. If you guys could carry the show for 10 minutes, then I could potentially take those pictures and do the formatting I need to do to get them on live. But
you do a song and a dance, a little tap.
So both of you guys mentioned ammonia. Let's talk about ammonia dosing as a possible new way to provide coral nutrition. You know, I had both Paletta and Sanjay on the show, and we discussed the use of ammonia rather than nitrate as a means for providing corals nitrate.
What's that?
Oh, I heard something, yeah. there's a lot of pictures you're sending me there, huh, Charles?
Yeah.
Let's see what we got here. Oh, boy, yeah. I might be able to get one of those on.
All right, never mind.
But yeah, like I said, if you guys can kind of run with the conversation, then maybe I can do this without, or I could try to multitask and really screw things up.
Yeah. No, you can't.
So, so all right. As I was talking about in terms of ammonia dosing, the reasoning behind it is that there is some evidence that corals are better at utilizing ammonia rather than nitrate to meet their nitrogen requirement. And by doing this, in terms of dosing ammonia, you know, that need would be better met. You know, ammonia is toxic at moderate levels to some fish, you know. So what are your thoughts on this topic in terms of dosing ammonia versus, you know, nitrate to a reef tank to potentially benefit coral health?
Well, I think it depends on what the level is and how frequently, if you're trying to maintain a level or if you're just like pulsing it in.
I think it would always be a pulse.
Yeah, should always be a pulse. A lot of the research that's done on the effects of these are pulsing it in, or some of them, they're constantly adding it and maintaining it at a certain level. But first of all, I don't have faith that our hobbyist test kits could measure low enough to really maintain a safer level. But I will say that, you know, the well water at Waikiki was higher in ammonia than the seawater was. And if you go back, I think it was 1994, the paper by Marlon Atkinson, where they looked at the well water going into a coral tank and the water leaving the tank, because they were open systems. So it had a constant input of this ammonia, and the water leaving the tank was zero. So they sucked it right up. There is a lot of research out there about the effects of ammonia and nitrate on corals. And for some of them, some of the studies have shown that ammonia is actually beneficial as it improves growth and other improves bleaching resistance, other things, whereas nitrate has the opposite effect. But it also, you have to think about your ratio. If you also have nitrate in the water, you're adding ammonia, your nitrogen, overall nitrogen levels are going to go up. It is true that it's metabolically easier for them to use ammonia, especially the zooxanthellae. And that's nothing new. That's been out there for decades. You know, it's the people that are adding it. I know a lot of people are adding nitrate, sodium nitrate or different forms of nitrate. Right. because their nitrogen levels are too low. But that's not a problem as long as it's not getting too high. And I think with the same would be true for ammonia. But there's also research evidence that has shown that if you maintain a certain level of ammonia, that it impacts the fecundity of the corals, the size of the oocytes, the eggs, basically, that they're producing. Basically, it impacts their reproductive ability. And I know that Mike had been mentioning in his article that his goal was to breed his corals. And so that is something to be aware of, that if you do add ammonia, that it could have a negative impact on their ability to spawn. Yeah. We've seen it in our coral spawning lab where when we get the wild colonies in, they spawn, everything looks great. The next year they spawn, the egg quality has really gone down. And I'm not saying that's because we have high ammonia, because we don't see ammonia, but we do have higher nitrate than normal, and that might be the cause. I don't really know. So there's a lot of factors. Like with anything in the reef hobby, you should always proceed with caution with doing new things.
Julian, your thoughts?
Right. Well, you know, the recent paper by Mike Valletta, you know, was pointing out the use of ammonium bicarbonate. And so that, you know, I think a lot of people were using ammonium chloride and maybe ammonium nitrate, different forms. And using bicarbonate is intriguing for a reef aquarium because you're, you know, feeding the coral and supplying some alkalinity. It's an interesting choice. You know, as Charles said, you know, it's been known for decades that ammonia is taken up readily by the zooxanthellae. And this is the reason why having fish in a reef aquarium or in a coral farm is so beneficial, because you feed the fish excrete ammonia right there where they're living next to the corals. So you have an on-site source of ammonia. This is the benefit that corals have in the wild of having schools of fish in their branches.
And there's lots of
eating plankton and releasing ammonia right there.
Yeah, there's lots of research that has shown that where they look at the growth rate of corals with or without fish living amongst the branches, and it's much higher with the fish. There's research about clownfish and how their ammonia they produce feeds their anemones, zooxanthellae. And there's also a lot of research papers about seabird colonies and how the reefs around islands with seabird colonies have much higher growth rates than without. You know, that's not only nitrogen, of course, but phosphorus that's being added. So all these things are being added, and these corals grow much better. What's not clear is none of these studies talk about what the alkalinity is at these sites or what the density of the skeleton is. Because it's well known that if they grow fast, their skeleton is going to be less dense.
Right. So all of that is useful information, but I think, you know, the average hobbyist says, well, how do I make my corals grow?
Right. You know,
or how do I keep them from dying?
I think, Sanjay is reporting, I think he's attributing, you know, his recent, coral health to the ammonia dosing, because that's, I think, the only thing that he had really tweaked in terms of any major changes to his tank over the last few months. But yeah, that's an advanced experiment for an experienced hobbyist, because he knows how to handle it in terms of the risks that are involved. Yeah. And
does he though?
I was gonna check that, Charles, because I know you might be skeptical about that.
I'm a skeptical reef keeper.
Right.
What are the dangers?
Oh, excess could harm the fish for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he sees his corals doing better, it could be just a sign that his tank was nitrogen limited to begin with. You know, it'd be interesting to know what values he's gotten for nitrogen and phosphorus. The problem is that the hobbyist test kits, it's, again, the resolution may not be there. I mean, I was looking at nitrogen phosphorus ratios for, I was reading an article about a public aquarium and their live coral exhibit and what their values were. And I did the math and it was like 200, the ratio, because their phosphate was 0.06. But if I changed the phosphate to 0.07, it was below, it was like 150. So, you know, that's within the realm of error of the test kit.
You know, here's a relevant question for a lot of people. And I'm going to mispronounce this name, Manoj Santosh. What's the best way to get accurate nitrates and phosphate readings? So that's like the million dollar question in terms of, I think nitrates are a lot easier to get accurate readings versus phosphates, right? I mean, even on ICP tests, that could be a challenge given all the different potential variables in play. How do people really, you know, try to get as accurate phosphate or phosphorus readings as possible? Charles is ducking that question.
He's ducking it. Well, let's see. There's a lot of test kits out there, and there are low-range test kits. And if you're in that low range, that's a good way to go. You know, if you've got a high range or a high level of phosphate, diluting your sample, of course, helps accurately diluting it. But these days we have both the titrating, the usual old kits with reagents, and now there are, from Hannah, the little checkers as well that assist. I don't have a go-to opinion yet on a brand or anything, but there are more kits available these days than there were even a few years ago. I know people are also just using the ICP kits or tests and getting readings that way.
Charles,
did you have something to add, Charles?
Of course, I missed everything you said. So,
I was going around in a circle about the availability of test kits these days and using low range kits for more precision.
Well, I think I know for our lab here at the Steinhardt, we have calibration solutions. So we have standards. So we know what the value is in a certain solution, and that's what we then calibrate our tests against. So that's really the only way to do it, I think, to get a better idea in terms of the accuracy of it, that it's close to a certain value, then you can make the adjustment. So if you know what you're, and also calibration curves. I'm not a chemist, you know, so there's a lot to it, a lot more to it. And so, you know, an ICP, I still challenge the validity of some of the value. I think Sanjay wrote a very large article about that. Definitely it's all over the map. And speaking with chemists that work with that equipment on a daily basis, you know, with the steps that they go to in terms of acquiring the specimens, preparing the specimens, how it's shipped and everything, how it's handled, is far different than what the hobbyist companies are doing. And so, you know, I think Rich Ross used to call it for confirmation bias. Well, that's a good number. I agree with that number. That's an accurate kit. That number can't be right. There's something wrong with the kit or something wrong with my ICP test. I will say that we recently sent out samples to one of the companies and they came back and told me that I had zero phosphate, like absolutely zero. And I said, it's impossible. My corals would be dead if I had zero phosphate. My lab tells me I had 0.358 or whatever. And my Honda kit tells me it says in that same ballpark. So, and they ran it twice and they told me it was zero. And so I'm thinking, well, how can that happen? Well, if
there's confirmation bias, your Honda kit.
There you go.
You didn't believe it.
My lab tech stuff. Anyway, I just don't understand how it could be zero. And the only thing I think of is there's bacteria in the water. They use it up, but then you would think that they would be vaporized and that the phosphorus would still be there, and in the past, you know, the ICP has been very good with the phosphorus, and they actually alerted us to an issue we were having with one of our own measurements. So, you know, it's take it with a grain of salt.
Charles, do you guys lean on ICP test results in terms of the minors and traces and dosing according to what the results report in the ICP test?
I used to, but then I was told one time I had a copper level, if I had that copper level, my fish would be dead. And when I sent it out to another lab that I trust, that's not in the hobby, it came back and told me I had basically zero. So it's all over. It really, there's a lot of variables involved. And I think Sanjay's article really goes into good detail on it. And also the Chris Jury and Rich Ross article on advanced aquarists back in, I think it was 2014 or 15, where they did a whole review of it as well. I mean, there's issues with it. No method is perfect, but I kind of go the route where, you know, I look at what the natural level is supposed to be, and I'll just add that once a month. And then, you know, I know that the Florida, down the Tampa, at the Coral Rescue Center there, that they're basically working with breeding corals. They're doing a palmata and whatnot. They just do big water changes every week. You know, that's they don't add anything else. And they're growing palmata and cervicornis.
Julian, your thoughts on ICP testing and using that to, you know, for trace element dosing?
Well, bear in mind when you're talking about trace elements, I think most of the ICP analysis that you're going to see is going to show zero because the concentrations are below the detection limit. So you don't really get a good handle on the levels of the trace elements. Now, where ICP then can be useful with trace elements is when you have excess. So if the measurement is correct, then it could be showing you that you're overdosing or there's some source of a trace element that, you know, you need to cut back on. And with some of the metals that, you know, you could get from magnets, the ICP test can give you a heads up right about at the time that it's a problem, sometimes before, and then you could search for and maybe find the source. With regard to using it, you know, this idea of it can tell you you've got so many parts per billion, now you need to add this much. In general, they're not that precise where you can rely on it. Maybe someday for certain trace elements we could do that, but right now I don't see that.
But there are different types of ICP as well. There's ICP OES and ICP mass spectrometry. The mass spectrometry has a lower detection limit. But I did ask one of the companies that was doing OES what their minimum detection limits were. And when they finally got the answers, you're right, Julian. I mean, the levels were far above what natural seawater levels were. So that test would tell you have zero, but you don't because the levels are so low. And that brings up the question, how important are those really, really low concentration elements to begin with? I mean, well, there's not a lot of research out there other than iron, manganese, you know, are really the ones
research will tell you is that we know are important. And those key ones that are important are nutritional type trace elements. And so they get depleted in captivity anyway. So adding them on a weekly basis, like you said, Charles, makes sense. Whether you need to use a test like ICP or some other method to measure how you're doing probably doesn't make sense because they're getting depleted anyway. And all you're really doing, just like adding food, you're adding the elements to make sure that there is some availability. Because you know that they're getting depleted.
There are professional labs out there that will do ICP. I don't know how some of them are not thrilled to do it with salt water because it gums things up, but they're not cheap. But they will produce values that I would probably put greater trust in.
John Wright, who is from England, is asking a question. Or maybe he's making a point. Are your eyes on your corals the best test kit? ?
Actually, I think our eyes could be maybe the cause of those bacterial infections. Sometimes I think about, you know, on the one hand, there's the eye of the farmer making the cow fat, but sometimes I look at my corals, and then the next day, a coral that I was admiring is sick, or a clam, like I said, and I think, damn my eyes, it's like the evil eye. But I know what his question means. There is something to be said for our experience and ability to notice when there's a problem, which then can inspire you to do tests when you see that there's, hey, the color's a little bit off, the polyp expansion is different than it usually is. Those can be indications of, you know, starting of a problem that you need to check.
But to equate, equate that with a certain element is, you know, I think, you know, the corals will tell you when they're not happy, but if it's you to figure out what's making them unhappy, and that can be challenging, because we don't really know what the role of a lot of these elements are and how critical they are. There are people that will swear up and down that, you know, you need to add zinc and cobalt and you need to add rubidium and that you add this and that. And there are companies out there that will tell you, you need to add this, 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 and this.
What's really interesting
is when you ask how what they base that on, they say experience.
Observation, right?
Like the guy from England. But there's something to be said for the value of the novice who's willing to just try these things and make observations and write down those observations over time. Then you need an academic to test those observations and take measurements and see whether there's actually something real to it. That's the beauty of the fact that we have a hobby like this, where there's so many participants playing around. You know, we do learn things that way.
And from a wide range of backgrounds and education that have, some of them have the resources to look deeper.
That's kind of what happened with the parasitic copepods, right? Red bugs, black bugs, whatever. Somebody came up with the interceptor treatment. Hobbyist,
right?
I believe. Yeah.
Yes.
Let's take a couple of questions from the viewers here. Reef for Life. What's your thoughts on stability and dosing bacteria, and where can we improve our future with all these different ways of cycling a tank?
Want to try that, Charles?
Let's see. I haven't really played around with any of these bacterial, and I would like to do some of these genomics tests just to find out, you know, what's in our water, what's in my system, and, you know, hopefully, I mean, there's some that can, oh, you can tell if this certain balance is off, and you're going to get ciliate outbreaks and things like that. I think Keith, you were the one mentioning that.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think there's some, again, it's an observational thing, but it'd be nice to have it empirically tested in a controlled environment. But, you know, I can say anecdotally, I know that if I let my phosphate get below 0.35 or above 0.45, I start to see instances of ciliate outbreaks, and I see some tissue recession, RTN, like weird stuff. And I've seen it happen enough times that those are my guardrails right now, because I right now our nitrates run around between 24 and 35 in that range, depending on what the water change schedule is like. So I'm looking for methods that I can get that down, and then I will let my phosphate come down as well. I know the Georgia Aquarium, their large coral tank, I mean, I think a lot of people have seen them and how well that coral's doing. Their phosphates were, last time I talked to them, they were 0.6, and their nitrate was 40.
Wow.
But his ratio comes out below 200, and it's, like I said, if the ratio is okay, then those values work. And I also looked at a hobbyist tank that I had, somebody gave our numbers years ago, and it was like the nitrates were in 100 something, and the phosphates were 1 or 2 point something, but the ratio was 38, which is fine, and the corals looked great, and they were. But, you know, there's all those hidden things. You know, what's their fecundity like? What's their growth rate? What's their skeleton like? Those kinds of things that we just don't know when we look at hobbyists. I think Kevin Erickson was telling me that somebody had sent him some scanning EMs of tank grown corals and comparing them to wild grown corals, and the porosity on the tank grown stuff is just like, it's like Swiss cheese.
Oh.
So it's not very dense.
Alan,
you go. Your turn.
Well, wasn't the question, if I heard it right, talking about bacteria dosing
stability.
Also for cycling? So,
yeah, it's thoughts on stability and dosing bacteria, and where can we improve our future with all these different ways of cycling a tank?
Okay. So, there are a number of industry manufacturers that supply different bacterial strains, some of which are used for initiating aquarium cycling it, and some of which are used for maintaining stability for various causes, supplying beneficial bacteria strains. I think that will continue to evolve, it's a real, a beneficial, they are beneficial products, things that you could be adding to your aquarium or starting your aquarium with them. We may see that also evolves to benefit what Charles was talking about, that, preventing disease, probiotic effects. So in addition to the old school, I maintain my cycle. I don't have issues of losing the nitrogen cycle in my system, but there may be these additional effects in preventing disease from dosing the bacteria. And the bacteria are food for filter feeders as well. So, at this point, I don't think either one of us can be commenting on certain strains to say that, this one or the other has this benefit or the other, but we know that they're beneficial.
Yeah, I guess that's why the manufacturers of those products kind of keep that those as like secret sauces and don't really list the bacterial strains.
And it's not just to corals. They're beneficial to fish, of course, yep. As well.
Ali Adapora, man, thank you so much for that very generous super chat. The comment is legends.
Super chat.
Oh, that's that? When folks can make a contribution to this live stream, a little donation there. So, and their comment gets highlighted and gets put right to the forefront. So that's that's a way to participate. Another
Keith, there's also a paper that just came out not that long ago about a certain type of bacteria that they're using now on wild corals that apparently outcompetes the virulent bacteria. And of course I cannot find it, but I will try to find it for you.
Yeah.
Another question by a viewer, Big ES, thoughts on bacterial plankton cultured by the hobbyist for feeding corals. So I guess that's just growing your own bacteria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
For the benefit of the corals. Yeah.
Yeah. It's something that's likely to be pursued.
Let me bring up
whether we'll be talking about that 5 or 10 years from now. Let's see.
Well, I wanted to bring this up because this is sort of like dovetailing into what we're talking about right here, which is kind of feeding corals and how potentially they could take in nutrition from bacteria. Mike Pelletta again. He keeps coming up.
What is it with that guy?
He and Sanjay just love to tinker,
Yes.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, we're learning. And, if they have a, I guess we're learning from any successes as well as any mistakes. Wow. So he's experimenting with what's called a concoction, which was devised by,
Thank you, Charles. He posted that paper.
Should I put that link in the, you want me to put that link in the chat there, Charles?
It's not a link. It's just, it gets the title of the paper.
Okay.
But you can put the title in there. People just Google that title. They'll find it.
Okay. So I'm talking about the concoction, which was devised by a young man named Alan Vaux. I don't know if you guys have been in the loop on this concoction, but the concoction is used to feed, this is the theory, the concoction is used to feed corals bacteria that have been stimulated and enhanced rather than feeding corals straight bacteria. So corals eat bacteria. The concoction is a grouping of bacteria, vitamins, amino acids, enzymes, probiotics, and a carbon source. Mike's also experimenting with adding trace elements to the mix. So what are your thoughts on this? It sounds to me like you're kind of just juicing up some bacteria with some stuff that corals might like to have that ingested into the corals. So the corals are eating the bacteria and all that good stuff gets passed through to the corals. What are your thoughts on that? And have you guys dabbled in that sort of thing?
Yeah, it does sound like a concoction, doesn't it? And hard to really tell what individual ingredient in the concoction would have, you know, a certain benefit, or whether the whole concoction is synergistically beneficial. It's hard to have a comment. I have not made a blend of that sort, a living blend. I have made foods, you know, to take powdered feeds and add amino acids, you know, so that when they hydrate, they're soaking that in and then use that as coral food. But to have live bacteria in the mix, it's an interesting idea.
Charles?
Yeah, I've not worked with this at all. It's an interesting idea as well. It's clearly cutting edge stuff. I'm putting in a bunch of links for you here that you can put into your chat later that are, if people have access to ResearchGate, they can get these papers talking about probiotics and coral aquaculture. The urban coral, I believe is the one in Miami, and the potential for bleaching resistant probiotic bacteria. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff on this. I mean, this is a growing field.
Yeah, I just added those links to the chat.
Great.
Oh yeah, here's the one I was talking about. It's a mitigation of Vibrio coralliticus induced coral bleaching through bacterial dysbiosis prevented by Ruggieria profunda, which is it's from a Chinese group. Delivering beneficial microorganisms for corals, rotifers as carriers of probiotic bacteria. I mean, there's a ton of stuff out there. So that's, I'm sure, what these companies are looking at. And I don't think there's anything proprietary in there. I think it's all out there. It's got to find it.
Yeah.
So in theory, do you think something like a concoction is, could in theory work?
Well, I mean, look at that paper Charles just mentioned. They were actually packaging the probiotic bacteria in rotifers. So that's an interesting way of doing it. But taking nutrients in a liquid solution and adding bacteria to it, that's a bit of a soup that, you know,
has the potential for disaster.
It sounds like
I was going to say, you know, can that, I think one of the arguments, you know, one of the cautionary tales about doing that is potentially, can you introduce pathogenic bacteria or at least give them a gateway to proliferate?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
And you're, you know, what are you doing to the whole biome, you know, balance on the coral and the mucus in the coral skeleton? I mean, it's a lot of unknowns there. I mean, it's on the cutting edge, but again, unless it's backed up by some rigorous controlled studies, how do you really pinpoint what the benefit is? I mean, clearly hobbyists are not going to be able to do that. Except maybe a very, very tiny percentage who maybe have access to that kind of capability, but
yeah.
But as I said, I mean, it's in the literature. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on probiotics. I just sent you a bunch of links.
Yep, but I posted
them. So there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot out there on it, and it's coming fast and furious, and because people are, you know, our reefs are dying, and we are trying to save what we can, and this is one way to, you know, to try and help corals to mitigate some of the stuff that we're doing to the planet.
Super chat. Thank you so much, Polo1126. I really appreciate that. Comment is keep up with the great guest topics and discussions. Yes. Gentlemen, we're about an hour and a half into it, and I don't want to take up too much more of your time. Julian, did you have something you wanted to Okay.
No.
So I was basically gonna wrap it and ask you guys if there's anything else you wanted to mention. We had a lot of topics to talk about here, and I think we focused on a few really good ones. So next time I have you back on, we'll dig in some of the other stuff.
Yeah, there was a lot of topics on your list.
Yeah.
So we have to come again.
Oh, Reef Exotica by Luis Acevedo. Thank you so much for that super chat. Julian, sorry they drank our tequila. We were going to share Reef stock at the studio. I'll make it up to you. I think it was Meckley.
Yeah.
Sounds like somebody was carbon dosing their system.
Yeah.
And taking a few carbon doses for themselves.
Yes.
Gentlemen, listen, I really appreciate you carving out some time this evening, late afternoon out there in San Francisco, Charles, and always learn a lot when I have you guys on and chatting. So really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. Happy to do it.
Thanks.
Yep.
Being there, Keith. Sharing all this information.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. So, you know, again, that's going to do it for the live stream. I want to thank my sponsors one more time, Champion Lighting and Supply. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Polo Reef. Check out that Polar Reef video that drops this Friday. Andrew and the team took the 8 Japanese koi cross country to the All American Koi Show in Las Vegas and scored a victory, winning the first grand place grand champion and more. I'm going to show that fantastic looking koi again. That thing is just unbelievable. I think I saw Andrew drop it in the chat that thing, it's a grand champion is about $200,000. That's what it's going to cost you for a grand champion. So, between the stresses transporting these massive fish, the honor of all Japanese judges in the fun of Vegas, the video is something you definitely don't want to miss. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polar Reef for video drop notifications. And my third sponsor is Fauna Marine. Fauna Marine combines proven aquaristic. I can't even pronounce that.
Aquaristic
experience, yeah, with innovative technology.
Yeah. Aquaristic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. With innovative technologies for modern sustainable reef keeping. However, in every one of their product developments, there is the same ambition to offer the customer the best possible product for their success. And big thank you to Paul, who's also the moderator, as well as the president of the Boston Reefer Society. Please join and support your local reefing clubs. They are so, so important to this hobby. I also want to let you know that all episodes of Rapid Reef Bum are available as podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Amazon. My next Rapid Reef Bum live stream will be on next Tuesday, April 2nd, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. My guest will be Tim Kelly from Purple Monster Corals out in the Solomon Islands.
Keith.
Yeah.
I have a suggestion.
What's that?
For next time, I think we should have tag team. Paletta Yoshi versus Delbic Sprung.
Oh boy, that'll be a good one. I got those guys coming on like in May, so I'll warn them.
Okay,
I'll warn them of that.
We're throwing down the gauntlet.
Paletta. I'm gonna warn them of that. guys throwing down the gauntlet. Yeah, that'll be awesome. That'll be fantastic. So if you want to check out the full upcoming schedule, visit reefbum.com under the YouTube section. So until next time, be safe and be well. Later.